Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. I am Isaac Weishaupt, and today we have a very special episode. We're going to hear an interview I did with Mary Wild. I begged and pleaded for her to allow me to share part of this discussion we had with my audience because it's really good. And she very happily obliged. So today we're going to get a good chunk of a full 90-minute conversation that we had about the occult symbolism in Eyes Wide Shut. Now, you've heard me talk about this film many, many times, but the reason this episode is different and this episode is important is because of the clarifying information that Mary provides to me and, of course, the audience. Now, Mary Wild, she's a very busy woman. I've discovered her listening to my favorite horror film podcast, Evolution of Horror, where she contributes to this Freudian analysis of horror films. She runs this Patreon-exclusive podcast on her Mary Wild channel. That's at patreon.com/Mary Wild, which is what I did the interview for, right? That's why I can't direct you to her free feed, because this is a Patreon-exclusive thing, so she was very kind to let me share part of this with you guys. And on her Patreon, she does film interpretation, philosophy, Freudian psychoanalysis of entertainment and stuff like that. She describes it as AMSR for intellectual gutter snipes, which is pretty accurate. She's very intelligent. A lot of the stuff they talk when she does her Freudian analysis, it's mind blowing to me. And she's of course done the projections lecture series at the Freud Museum itself. So very much a Freudian expert. And she's got a ton of great episodes on her Patreon. I actually subscribed myself. There's a show on human encounters with AI in cinema with films like 2001 A Space Odyssey and so on, right? She's got full episodes examining David Cronenberg films and so much more, including this one with your boy, right? We did a full 90 minutes of fire on Eyes Wide Shut. So you're going to have to go there to get the full show. I'm going to give you a good chunk of it, though. And you can go there to patreon.com/Mary Wild. I'll put the link in the show notes where you can get the rest of the film. We go through the entire film, including a very good conversation at the end about the final scene where Ziegler gives Bill Harford the warning about messing with the elites and their sex and death rituals, the Thanatos and Eros forces. So take a listen. You're going to love it, and you're going to want more. So you got to go to patreon.com/Mary Wild to get the full show. Take a listen.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to my Patreon channel. I hope you're all doing well and taking care. Joining me all the way from Utah is my special guest, Isaac Weishaupt. Welcome to the show, Isaac. How are you?
Hi, Mary. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm such a huge fan of your work. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Likewise, the pleasure's all mine. I've heard a lot of your Freudian stuff on Evolution of Horror, so this is pretty cool for me too, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm just going to do a bio read for you before we get started.
Okay.
Isaac Weishaupt is the host of Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture Podcast, as well as the author of 9 books. He's been studying the occult and presenting theories about symbolism found in pop culture since 2011. He's been a featured guest on Coast to Coast AM, Tinfoil Hat, Sirius XM, and many other shows. So my first question to you is, how did you become interested in occult symbolism? And when did you start to like notice it manifest in pop culture?
That's a great start. And I'll try to be brief. I have this sort of strange journey, and this, I feel like my sort of worldview is very hard to put into a singular box, so I'm gonna go through my background and sort of catch up to where we are today.
Sure.
I grew up in a sort of Protestant Christian church. Wasn't I mean, it wasn't fundamentalism, but there was elements of that. Like, they were really shameful about the media we consume, that, you know, we weren't allowed to go to the movie theaters for a while. You weren't allowed to dance. You know, sex was obviously very a shameful sort of thing. And there was a lot of things that I, growing up in that environment, I didn't like, and it really sort of repelled me, because my mother was into church and my father shared similar views with me, from what I understand now. Mm-hmm. And he never went. And I always, I took after my father, and I grew up watching just tons of horror movies. I mean, I'm 43 now, so we're talking, you know, the 80s and early 90s. I watched just tons of horror movies with my dad, which gave me my love of horror movies. And I would say, dare say, my initiation into being interested in the occult. So
yeah,
that in the, you know, the enjoyment I got from watching those kinds of things would, you know, flow into Aliens. I was really into X-Files for a while. And in the 2000s, I basically got red-pilled a couple times. I call them my red-pilled daddies. I had red Bill Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse. Mm-hmm. And in like 2002, then in around 2005, a buddy loaned me a copy of David Icke's Freedom Road VHS cassette tape. And he does really, they both do good jobs at sort of trying to approach this whole realm as a worldview. And I didn't really understand it. I always thought it was really interesting and fun and quirky. And, you know, I liked Ancient Aliens and things like that. And it was always a sort mm-hmm. of fun escapism for me to look at the world through those sort of lenses. And in, let me go back to my spirituality, because that plays a role in this, I think.
Yeah.
When I was 16, I didn't have to go to church anymore, so I didn't. I stopped. You know, of course, this whole time I was very much into all kinds of bad things I shouldn't have been doing. And but I also I don't want to say indoctrinated, but I was sort of, you know, I was indoctrinated into Christianity, so that feels natural to me. And I do still to this day, you know, believe in Christ. I question a lot of the rules and dogma. I also am very compassionate towards people that are atheist or don't believe in it at all, because I get where they're coming from, because I have a lot of doubts as well, right? Yeah. Like, I always tell people, I'm a Christian. I'm very much not a good one, so don't come to me for some kind of spiritual leadership, and because I don't really get into that on my podcast or my books much. Mm-hmm. But I do think there is a spiritual element to all of the things going on in our world, and especially entertainment. So I had all these interests. I met my wife. She and I started, she's Greek Orthodox, so I became Greek Orthodox, and I was super into Orthodoxy for several years, because they had more of a traditional mystical sort of element to it that really resonated with me. So in 2011, I started a blog. I was getting ready to go to grad school, and I had a two-year break, so I was like, okay, I was just so used to researching, writing, and regurgitating that I took it to a blog, which is IlluminatiWatcher.com. And I blogged for several years, but almost immediately I realized that I should write a book. So I've written 9 books over the years, podcasting since 2014. And as you talked about the bio, I've done a ton of shows. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to me, because I sort of niched down, because my blog used to be, you know, I was into hip hop. I still am, hip hop, horror movies, and conspiracy type topics, aliens and things like that. Mm-hmm. But then I niched down to strictly the occult and as it manifests in entertainment symbolism. And, I'm really into the alien UFO sort of disclosure thing. But my favorite element of all this is definitely, I guess film studies would be the right term, but I didn't go to college for, I took one course on philosophy, but I went to college for engineering. So
that's,
I took one intro to film, one philosophy course. So like, I think we were talking about this offline, you know, you and your audience are probably far more educated in some of these things, even some of the topics we might touch on today. But you know, I've learned a lot over the years, reading just tons of books, you know, Carl Jung and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then, of course, learning from your Freudian stuff too. So Yeah, but that's kind of where I'm at today, is I'm just focused in on those particular realms, occult religions and occult philosophies, and how they manifest as symbolism, archetypes in media.
Amazing. I mean, it all comes across really well on your YouTube channel and your podcast. You're a really good storyteller. You're really good at synthesizing all of these seemingly disparate, you know, bits of ideas and theories and facts. And I recall you mentioning even on YouTube that you had to change the name of your show to distance yourself from the term conspiracy because it had become tainted. Like, yes. It just seems to me like that it's perfectly legitimate to think critically minded and not automatically accept the official line that governments and powerful figures want us to accept. But somehow this skepticism is deliberately made to be taboo. There's like this bad connotation now to the word conspiracy. So how do we combat this?
And that's an interesting point you bring up there, because that is in fact what happened. And over the years, I've been banned off of several platforms, including YouTube. I had maybe 76,000 subs on YouTube at my peak, and they kicked me off in 2016. So I've had to restart a couple channels, and you know, I don't upload everything there. I upload periodically this, that, or the other, and I still get red flags here and there. It's really annoying, but my podcast was called Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture back when I started it in 2014. And as most people know, the landscape of politics and all kinds of different subjects, I don't want to use certain terms because they're very controversial terms. A lot of things have changed, and we all see censorship everywhere. And I do believe that there is, you know, much like the original coining of the term conspiracy theorist back with the JFK assassination, there is definitely a movement for disinformation to try to taint the term conspiracy theorist. And I do think that in recent years, last few years, we'll say that the powers that be have done a really good job at making a lot of these conspiracy theories and theorists seem like something they're a little more distasteful than I grew up in. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and then also in my personal life or in my online life, when people see that, they're like, oh, you do conspiracy theories, they immediately think I'm like this Donald Trump loving anti this, that, or the other. I'm like, no, that's not really my angle. You know, not really my angle. The new term of occult symbolism and pop culture fits the agenda of what I actually talk about mostly. So it's actually a better term for what I do.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, I think there's some overlap in our work in that, you know, Freud was something of an OG conspiracy theorist too. You know, he was always reminding us that the ego is not master in his own house. That is to say, our conscious personality thinks it's in control of everything, but all the while, you know, we're governed by unseen unconscious forces that really run the show. And like this topography of some other hidden entity having its own agenda and running our life is something that, you know, you comment on regularly as well. I think your listeners would find so much that is illuminating in Freud. By the way, I especially loved your episode on Rihanna's Super Bowl halftime show. It was really cool.
Yeah, that was a popular one. Well, and I think you're right with the Freudian stuff because you know, and Carl Jung, he was a Gnostic. So these guys were really questioning the nature of reality. And I think if there is an Illuminati, quote unquote, and I should also mention my last name of Weishaupt is not Isaac Weishaupt was not my real name. That is a pseudonym, a very poorly chosen one, turns out in hindsight, because everyone, you know, in the conspiracy world, everyone doesn't trust anyone. And they think, oh my God, you're related to Adam Weishaupt, the Bavarian Illuminati founder. And I'm like, no. Just a dumb pseudonym. It's not my real name. But I think that the Illuminati, they know these things. They know this, you know, your Freudian analysis of stuff. They know how our minds work. And it really is maddening when you start trying to play chess with what they're doing, and you start trying to figure out why they're doing it, how many moves ahead are they, that kind of stuff. It kind of drives you nuts sometimes. But yeah, I'm with you that Freud and Jung, they definitely were on the right track as far as questioning the nature of reality. I'm not smart enough to know if their final sort of conclusions about what is real or accurate or not, but a lot of things they say, when I come across it, when I stumble across it, I think, oh man, that's kind of interesting. Like, they're kind of right. You know, the whole the ego, super ego, id sort of structure.
The shadow and Jung. I mean, you especially reference Jung quite regularly, I've noticed, which is awesome. And you know, not surprising, because it's that kind of curiosity about alternative explanations to what we're given, and not necessarily just accepting this authoritarian official line. I really commend you for doing that. I think it's really good.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I try to learn. And you know, Jung, my first experience with Jung was reading his book about flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started digging into him, and I was like, oh man, this guy was like a Gnostic and doing all this kind of wild stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Amazing. Well, I invited you on because I wanted to discuss Stanley Kubrick's erotic mystery psychological drama film Eyes Wide Shut, which was released in 1999. And it's about Dr. Bill Harford, played by Tom Cruise, who is shocked when his wife Alice, played by his then real life wife, Nicole Kidman, reveals that she had contemplated having an affair a year earlier. So this character, Bill Harford, then embarks on a night-long adventure during which he infiltrates the masked orgy of an unnamed secret society. So, Isaac, you were a dream guest for me to look at Eyes Wide Shut because of your expertise in noticing the patterns of occult symbolism. So I was curious, first of all, what is your relationship to this film? Are you a Kubrick fan?
Yes, yes, yes. So Eyes Wide Shut is probably my most analyzed film that I've ever looked at, barring the current obsession I have with Twin Peaks,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure if I know myself throughout this show, I'm going to probably bring up Twin Peaks several times, because I've been absolutely just, I watched it for the first time a few months ago, and I burned through all the shows, the movie, the books, and I'm just like, I can't stop thinking about it. So I'm doing this whole super mega deep dive on Twin Peaks currently that I'm working on. But there's a lot of parallels between Lynch and Kubrick and Eyes Wide Shut and Twin Peaks, and I'm sure we'll cross those paths here sometime. Mm-hmm. But I grew up with Kubrick. Like I said, my father was very, I don't know if socially liberal is the right word, but he was very liberal with the media I could consume. So I grew up watching, I watched A Clockwork Orange when I think I was 13 or 14.
Amazing.
And like I said, but I grew up, I watched every nasty little horror movie you could imagine. I remember I was like, I think I was 8 or 9 or 10, and I would have to, we used to keep the dog locked up in the backyard in this big, massive cage, which, I mean, completely unacceptable by today's standards, as it should be. But this is the 80s, right? And I would have to let him out at night. And I remember, and we had this, we had kind of a big yard with multiple trees. And I remember just being terrified because it was so dark. And I remember thinking Jason Voorhees was behind every tree. I mean, my mind just... like, I get why people don't show kids these movies, because I mean, it made me feel like insane. I was always terrified as a kid, but yet I'm drawn to this stuff still to this day.
I can relate.
Yeah, I'm sure. So I've seen A Clockwork Orange when I was a kid. I saw Full Metal Jacket. So I grew up with Kubrick. And in fact, in 99, when the movie was in theaters, me and my wife went and saw it. Yeah. We were just dating at the time. And I don't remember what I was expecting. I think I was part of the camp that thought, oh, we're going to see these wild sex scenes with, you know, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. And it turned out it wasn't really like that. And But something resonated for me. I don't know what. And I liked it. I enjoyed it. So when I started going through the red pill stages, I was digging into Jay Widener's work. He did a bunch of Stanley Kubrick. What was it called? Kubrick's Odyssey, I think is what he called it. Is this film, this, you know, YouTube documentary style analysis of The Shining and 2001 and Eyes Wide Shut. And that's what made me sort of start digging into Eyes Wide Shut. And since then, I think it was my second or third book was called Kubrick's Code, where I went through 2001, Clockwork Orange, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut to talk about all the symbolism in those films. Now, if I look at that book today, I don't want to say it's cringy to me, but there's a lot of elements there that I think, boy, I really missed a lot of big symbols in this movie and a lot of different ideas. So over the past maybe 3 years, I reinvestigated Eyes Wide Shut. I did, I think, 6 or 7 different full episodes talking about the movie from different perspectives. And I've read the, I mean, it's like I said, this is probably my most obsessed film. I read the Making of Eyes Wide Shut book, and I've read, I even hunted down a book called Cult and the Occult that Kubrick was using to study to prepare for Eyes Wide Shut. I found a copy of that in the UK, ironically, and you know, it was like $140 or something.
Oh, wow. I mean, since you mentioned earlier, like, the connection with Lynch as well, I'm sure you heard this before, but when Kubrick was filming The Shining, he regularly had little screenings of David Lynch's Eraserhead, like, on the set.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was only trying to, like, inspire his cast and crew, not necessarily by the storyline itself. It's just, he just wanted to create, like, this atmosphere that was contained in Eraserhead. He wanted to somehow transfer that energy onto, you know, The Shining. So those two are, like, really spiritually connected for sure. So I'm not surprised that you love them both.
Oh, that's a great way. I might put that in my little analysis.
Yeah.
Spiritually connected. All right. Yeah, they really are. There really are a lot of parallels in their work. So
for sure.
In fact, I watched Eraserhead a couple weeks ago and noticed right at the beginning when he's getting on an elevator, it's the same floor as the waiting room floor. I don't know if you guys know that.
Anyway,
that was it. It's the same as that white and black zigzag pattern, you know?
I love it. Anyway. So cool. Okay, so let's run through the main sections of Eyes Wide Shut, starting with Victor Ziegler's party, which features a glamorous, extravagant surface in contrast to hidden taboo activities. And I was curious, like, how do you read this scene? Because we have Ziegler obviously greeting his guests down in the main foyer of the house. But then as the party is, like, kicking off, we later find out that he's in the bathroom with apparently a sex worker who's just OD'd on heroin and cocaine. So, like, it's just this contrast between what he's showing outwardly publicly and then what he gets up to behind closed doors. I was curious to get your take on that.
It's kind of a parallel to the mask they wear at the orgy house, right? But for me, Ziegler's an interesting character because, to me, he plays he's representative of the Illuminati. He's one of the elites. And fun fact, Harvey Keitel was originally supposed to be playing that character of Ziegler, but he got tired of Kubrick's film process because Kubrick infamously takes hundreds of takes sometimes because he's this eccentric perfectionist, like Tom Cruise walking through the doorway 100 times or you know, that kind of stuff. But anyway, and Nicole Kidman once said that Kubrick, there's a reason why Kubrick does this. He makes the actors repeat the scenes to get it out of their consciousness so that they actually perform from a deeper subconscious level, which is pretty fascinating, right? But Ziegler is a German name that means brick maker, is what I've read, which is another reference to the Freemasons, which are bricklayers, right? In his home, he even has the Freemasonic floor, the black and white checkered floor, which is the symbolism of duality you see in Freemason lodges. They call it the mosaic pavement. So you see a lot of this sort of referencing of the Freemasons. And in fact, you see the, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but at the Somerton Orgy Mansion, mm-hmm. Red Cloak is sitting on a Freemasonic throne of a double-headed eagle.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But in Ziegler's home, it's like this Illuminati temple. You even see 8-pointed stars all over the place, which is symbolic of the Star of Ishtar, Semiramis, this Babylonian goddess worship thing that you constantly see referenced in films. And then you mentioned how there's a bit of an initiation ritual right off the bat, because like you said, Ziegler and his wife, they meet Dr. Bill and Alice downstairs and they, you know, exchange pleasantries. Mm-hmm. And then later on, Dr. Bill gets called upstairs because Ziegler's in the bathroom because he's cheating on his wife with a prostitute while his wife's downstairs with a woman who's like, I don't even know, a third of his age.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Ziegler is he's very blasé about this young prostitute who's damn near dead from doing drugs after he's having sex with her. And I can't help but think that this is a test to see if Tom Cruise's character, Dr. Bill, if he can be initiated, if he can keep this harpocratic vow of silence, because as we find out, he's going to witness a lot darker stuff. Yeah. So it's almost like a test what he does.
Trying to gauge the limits of maybe his morality or whether he's able to keep a secret. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. Very interesting.
The morality plays a big role in all of this stuff. That's one theory for why these Illuminati types do what they do. They always do this horrific stuff to, you know, women and kids and all these theories of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And the theory is that how much do they embrace I call it duality. I think that's an oversimplified thing, and you're probably far more intelligent on the subject of duality than I am, but I think it's the perspective I see in my research is that they're saying, look, there's no such thing as good, there's no such thing as evil. These are social constructs. You know, when they do something evil, it's almost like they fully embody this idea of saying, no, that's a social construct. I can, you know, murder somebody or do whatever, and it's really not a big deal. Like, there's no such thing as morality. That's a social construct.
And they can easily traverse those boundaries with not too much of a crisis in conscience.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
That's it. That's so interesting because, like, Bill is this guy who's always, like, flashing his medical ID card. Like, he prides himself in having this kind of trustworthy public persona. And yet at the same time, you know, he is also, like, dabbling in these, like, hidden corners of respectable society. So it is this kind of like push and pull for sure. And also,
and it's intoxicating. Yeah. It's intoxicating to be surrounded by these, you know, powerful people. I know from my own experience that, like, I always name drop the rocker Dave Navarro. I did his show a while back. I did a couple shows with him years ago, and I was very enamored by it because the irony is I did a piece on my podcast about how he was, you know, he's got all these Illuminati symbols tattooed on him and he does all these Illuminati things because he has Aleister Crowley symbols tattooed on his elbows. You know, that's the biggest one. And he thought it was cool. He messaged me out of nowhere. Hey man, like you want to come on my show and talk about how I'm in the Illuminati? I was like, heck yeah, I do. You know?
Wow.
And I was very enamored by it. Right. And a lot of people, they sort of tuned in and they see, you know, and I'm like a star effer, right? Like, I'm really impressed by this whole thing. I'm like, oh my God, I'm talking to Dave Navarro. Like, this is crazy. And people are like, well, he's in the Illuminati. Why are you being buddies with him? And I'm like, I don't know, but I like it. You know, but he was very friendly with me and very courteous. So, like, I don't know. Like, so I kind of get it that, you know, you get enamored by power and fame. And I'm not saying I would go to the lengths that Dr. Bill would by any stretch, but I get where it's coming from.
I think that if people get a chance to be an observer, I think they're right not to pass it up, because it's like gaining access to a world and you're coming into it critically. You're not just going to get swept up, you know, into it. So anyway, like going back to Ziegler's party, I mean, it features the first appearance of Nick Nightingale, who's a med school dropout turned pro piano player. And Bill Harford, like, he's quite surprised to see him there. In a way, Nick Nightingale is his dark double, because he's sort of getting a glimpse of what his, you know, his life would have been like if he dropped out, if he hadn't become this eminent doctor. So what is the purpose of Nick's character in the film, do you think?
Well, I think, so I read the book Dream Novella by Arthur Schnitzler, that this, which was the root of Kubrick's obsession. You know, for his whole life, he had always thought about this book and always thought about how he wanted to make a film. But to me, when I see his character, which you're right, he sort of has this inverse, even his tuxedo is white with a black tie versus Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like inverse colors, right? But the nightingale is the bird that sings at night. And then throughout the film, Nick is performing at night. He's performing at the Ziegler's and then the Sonata Cafe and then the Summerton Orgy House.
That's right.
And at the Orgy House, he's wearing the mask over his eyes, the hoodwink that the Freemasons use. It's a symbol they put on their initiates. When they go through the initiation rituals, they put this hoodwink over their eyes, and it represents the ignorance that they have before they're initiated into, you know, the secret teachings and the secret dogma of the Freemasons.
Yeah.
And that's what Nick Nightingale's character does. He's not supposed to know what's going on. He says in the film, look, I go into this house and I play the piano, but I can't see what's going on. One time I could see past it and I saw all this crazy stuff, right? It represents the darkness, and it's part of the ritual element of isolation needed to sort of suppress the ego and so the new one can come to the surface. As far as initiation goes in Freemasonry, it's supposed to allow the initiate to go deeper into the self, which, you know, that's what Nicole Kidman basically says Stanley Kubrick's technique is to through repetition force the actor to go deeper into the self and subconsciously act. So there's and there's a lot of, you know, but basically he shows us an initiate with the suppressed ego, and you know, the whole idea is that's what you see in Freemasonry as a way of suppressing the ego for the new one to come to the surface.
Okay. And in a way, I mean, the fact that he's a piano player, if we take the signifier being player, that can also be transferred onto Bill Harford being a player in a bigger game. And he's meant to have his eyes, in a way, like, you know, covered to a certain extent. He gains a certain access to a knowledge that's forbidden to him, and then a spectacle is made out of him, and a threat is put onto him. We can get to that later, but he is expected to just play along, you know, be a player, be a team player, etc.
And he could also be going on that player vibe. It's kind of, he's the guy who gets Bill Harford to the house.
You know, right.
He's the one that sort of leaves the breadcrumbs of, hey, you should come check this out kind of thing.
So in terms of then Alice's confession soon after the party that she fantasized about sleeping with a naval officer some time ago when they'd been on a family vacation, there's so much that's been said about this. I have my own theory about the significance of naval officer. You know, in Freudian theory, there's this concept of the navel of the dream. Navel obviously being spelt like, you know, your belly button the different way, N-A-V-E-L. So the navel of the dream is like the center point of the dream, that bit of the dream that can never be interpreted. It's like this little nucleus that's like infuriatingly impenetrable. And all of the other aspects of the dream orbit around the navel of the dream. So it just strikes me as interesting that Alice should have fantasized about a naval officer, because then this becomes this like frustrating center point inside, you know, Bill Harford's psyche, around which all of his actions orbit. He becomes super obsessed, and we see all of those like intrusive thoughts, flashes in his mind of what he's imagining would have been like an affair between his wife and a naval officer, which never even happened. Incidentally, I should just tell you, Isaac, that I gave a talk about this very theory, like my idea about the naval officer being like Freud's navel of the dream. And a guy who wrote a book about Eyes Wide Shut ripped me off. He took my theory and put it in his book, and he didn't.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. And he didn't credit me. And when I confronted him about it, he said it was an oversight. And that, you know, he apologized, whatever, but he said he would correct it in the second edition, which I'm yet to see. I don't know whether that's ever going to happen, but I just wanted to put it out there that he ripped me off. I know, what an asshole.
Yeah, but that's terrible. I hate that. That's why with a lot of my stuff, like for instance, Twin Peaks, I'm planning on writing a book with all this research I'm doing. And I'm hesitant to read anyone's. There's a million theories about, you know, Twin Peaks and Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah,
and I hesitate to read anyone's stuff because I want to come up with my own theory, and I'm sure a lot of it's already been walked over. And I want some kind of plausible deniability because I don't want it on my conscience. But there are. I listened to the Diane podcast for Twin Peaks, and they've been dropping a few gems here and there. So I'm like, God dang it. So I kind of write down, okay, attribute this to Diane. Cause I'm with you. Like, that's a huge deal to me.
You know, like that thought map, you know, in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, you know, the Charlie.
Yeah. I need to.
I feel like you need to have that. Like, it's just so good.
Yeah. It is a lot. In fact, there's a poster called the Great Awakening poster. I put in my office studio wall here. I should make one for Twin Peaks because it's just as sort of sprawling.
Exactly, it's so cool. Oh my gosh.
But I do want to focus on Eyes Wide Shut. That's why we're here, right?
I want to know your thoughts on why you think her confession about her fantasy affected Bill so much.
Okay, so we're gonna go personal here, and I'm okay with it because I've been to therapy many times over the years. All right, there you go. Hope you enjoyed that because, man, this is wild. And I'm definitely getting Mary on our podcast. We're definitely going to get into this Freudian analysis of film because this is, of course, right up our alley. But if you want to get the full 90-minute discussion, including that final scene analysis where we talk about Ziegler's threats to Bill Harford about, you know, messing with the Illuminati, basically. And then you unlock, she's got dozens and dozens of great episodes on there. Like I said, I signed up already. I'm plowing through them myself. You can check out her Patreon at patreon.com/Mary Wild. Link in the show notes as always. And until next time, stay woke.